Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where we're having, as you know, a discussion on euthanasia with the topic Voluntary Euthanasia, Impacts on Individuals and Society. Our two speakers will lead off with Penny Hackett. She's a solicitor and currently working in the financial services industry and president of Dine with Dignity New South Wales. And you can get in touch with her about this forthcoming book, The Damage Done by Go Gentle Australia, which is linked with Dine with Dignity. And talk to Penny about that or check it on the Go Gentle website. And then the Reverend Peter Curti, who's a senior research fellow at the Centre for Independent Studies. He's also associate professor at the School of Law at Notre Dame University, and he's the author of Euthanasia, Putting the Culture to Death? And we've got copies of that book for sale after, so you can talk to Anne up the other end. And so many thanks to both our speakers, and Penny Hackett, welcome to the Sydney Institute. Peter Curti's making a return visit, but your first time here, and you're very welcome. Thank you.
Can everyone hear me okay? Okay, voluntary euthanasia, impacts on individuals and society. Now, most commentary on this issue looks at the impacts, what the impacts might be on society if laws are passed to allow a person choice over their death. Now, we really need to flip that argument and examine the impacts on society right now, which result from not having these individual rights. So the question is, would passing assisted dying laws actually benefit society? I'm not going to bother with definitions and labels, call it what you like, but what we're discussing is the right of a mentally competent adult with unrelievable suffering from a terminal illness or medical condition who seeks assistance to die, whether by their own hand or with the help of a doctor. Euthanasia, assisted dying, assisted suicide, medical aid in dying, take your pick. Just remember that the word is voluntary. And I'll use the expression voluntary assisted dying, or VAD, during the talk tonight. So there's various different models around the world, but the new Victorian law and what's proposed in other states requires sign-off from two doctors, detailed eligibility criteria, safeguards, written and oral requests, waiting periods, etc. Now, the detail is very important, but not unless we've dealt with the fundamental concerns. So I'm very happy to talk detail with anyone if you have several hours to spare. So is there anyone here who doesn't plan on dying? Clearly not. Death is part of life. We all face it, and most of us will experience the death of loved ones. Many of you here will have already experienced the death of loved ones. And was it a good death or a bad death? How did you feel, and did it make you think about how you might die yourself? Does it make you fearful? Extrapolate those feelings to the broader community. Everyone is impacted by this. Each death, yes, it involves an individual, but the issue of death and dying impacts society as a whole. And then what is society? Don't have much time to philosophise here, but I believe that society comprises the collective experiences and beliefs of individuals in our community. And a more important question is who gets to speak for society? So I'll touch on the main arguments raised by opponents of VAD. Palliative care will be damaged. Palliative care can address all suffering. Suicide will become normalised. It is impossible to construct adequate safeguards, and the doctor-patient bond will be forever destroyed. Now, these are important issues, and they warrant careful consideration. And there's many other arguments, the most ridiculous in my mind being the risk of illegal harvesting of organs, and I won't dignify that with a response. So who is it that argues against assisted dying? there is generally a religious connection. It's often concealed, but almost always present. And faith groups are perfectly entitled to their views. But I ask whether it's appropriate for groups representing the minority to claim to speak for society when we know that the huge majority of the community support VAD laws. All recent independent surveys show support sitting around 85%, including among a majority of Christians. So we'll get down to the coalface. So often these discussions tend to be very theoretical and tied up with philosophical arguments. And that debate is often casually dismissive of the experiences of people who are involved in the actual dying and those around them. So how about we step down from the rarefied air of the intellectual debate and go to the bedsides? So as I was preparing this speech, I received this email from Kylie. Dear Gabrielle Upton, on 30 November, I watched my beautiful, dignified 83-year-old mother finally choke to death on her own regurgitated fecal matter after 3 days of slow suffocation from it, much of which she was conscious for. This was not an unusual death, in fact, quite standard for sufferers of stomach and endometrial cancer. In 2005, my father drowned in his own fluids as his lungs filled due to heart failure. It took 2 weeks, again, a common occurrence. Both begged to be helped to die, and there was nothing I could do. An awful experience, but not an isolated one, and not the worst that I've heard. I've read over 3,000 messages sent to New South Wales MPs bearing witness to the end-of-life suffering and the trauma that it leaves behind. Most are family members, some patients, many are nurses and healthcare workers who attest to the trauma. And assisted dying is not actually principally about dying. It's about ending suffering and relieving fear so that a person can make the most of their remaining life. Indeed, many people don't take their lethal dose. It's sufficient comfort to know that it's there. You can rest assured that people want to live and will fight for life until they reach the point where they can bear no more. For some people, death is not the worst thing that can happen to them. So, palliative care. I cannot stress enough the importance of palliative care to the community. It needs much more funding and support, but it can work hand in hand with assisted dying laws. They are not opposing. It's claimed that VAD laws would cause irreparable harm to the palliative care sector and therefore to society. But Palliative Care Australia, their peak body, has just released two reports after reviewing evidence from around the world. They found no harm to the sector, evidence of no harm to the sector, and it seems that assisted dying laws may actually enhance palliative care. I think that's case closed on that argument. Opponents also claim that VAD is not necessary because all bad deaths can be avoided by better funded palliative care. Much as we wish it were otherwise, palliative care cannot address all suffering at end of life. Their own data indicates that in 4 to 8% of patients, they cannot control their physical symptoms. But some still refuse to acknowledge this, despite the evidence and the testimony of those who've witnessed terrible suffering. And often this has taken place in our most prestigious palliative care facilities. What's suffering? For most people, palliative care does a pretty good job dealing with physical symptoms, pain, breathlessness, and nausea. But suffering is more than that. Psychological and existential suffering can be much more profound. Loss of independence, inability to move or communicate with loved ones, the things that make life worth living. No palliative care can give you back control of your bladder and bowels, restore your ability to speak, eat, or even swallow your own saliva. Suffering can't be determined objectively. What is unbearable for one person may well be tolerable for another. And who among us is arrogant enough to determine when a dying person has suffered enough? And some people believe that suffering is somehow connected with the person's character. And if you desire to avoid suffering, it implies some weakness. It's taking the easy way out. Some, fortunately few, think that suffering is heroic, part of the human condition, a necessary struggle, and so on. Believe me, there is no grace in suffering. It's impossible to separate this thinking from theology, where the concept of a natural death, in God's time, is fundamentally disturbed by a person seeking to exercise personal autonomy. And people have every right to hold this view, but they cannot claim to speak for the majority of others in society who don't share that belief. Going back to the coalface, unpleasant as it is, in the final stages, palliative care boils down to a handful of drugs for pain, sedation, and to reduce the secretions that cause people to choke and gurgle as their lungs cease to function. It's a waiting game, so the patient is frequently starved and dehydrated to expedite the process. It sounds like torture, but it's a well-accepted practice in palliative care. And for those who still have uncontrollable symptoms, they may, if they're lucky, be given what is called terminal or palliative sedation. It's effectively an induced coma. Often this brings on death quite quickly. Sometimes it can take weeks. It sounds a lot like slow euthanasia, doesn't it? Shouldn't the mentally competent patient have the right to ask for a drug to end their life peacefully and quickly instead of dying slowly and painfully? In reality, people die badly even with optimal end-of-life care. This is not confined to the individual. It impacts loved ones who often carry the trauma with them for years. If you want to know about the trauma caused by bad deaths, ask the nurses. They are at the bedsides. That's why the Nurses and Midwives Federation strongly supports assisted dying laws, and they actively lobbied the New South Wales and Victorian parliaments to pass them. Death inevitably involves grief, but it need not involve suffering or trauma. So suicide. Legalised assisted dying is clearly distinct from the tragedy of suicide, and I mean suicide in the conventional sense. Suicide prevention bodies recognise this. One of the large American groups states that, unlike most cases of suicide, the person who has requested and receives aid in dying does not typically die alone and in despair, but most frequently where they wish, at home and with the comfort of his or her family. Now, the reality is that the absence of assisted dying laws is causing people to commit suicide because they fear the prospect of a terrible death. The Victorian coroner testified in Parliament in 2017 about these violent, distressing and lonely suicides. People facing a terrible death due to illness. They chose death to avoid their future suffering. He estimated that one Victorian a week was taking this step, and he described hangings, gunshots, poisonings, and a 90-year-old man with cancer who repeatedly shot himself in the head and neck with a nail gun. The WA coroner said recently that over 10% of suicides in his state fall into that category. The impacts of these deaths go far beyond the individual who's died. Head of the Western Australian Police Unit has called for VAD laws, saying there would be less horrific suicides and first responders would be spared having to see as many graphic scenes, most of which stay with them forever. My friend's mum jumped in front of a train at Lynfield Station. She had late-stage throat cancer. She couldn't eat or speak. She saw no other option and she had access to no other means. Horrendous for her family, obviously, but consider the impact on the train driver, emergency services workers and members of the public. In 2017, cancer sufferer Clive Deverell took his life, leaving the words, "Suicide is legal, euthanasia is not." But he was no ordinary cancer sufferer. He was head of the WA Cancer Council for 20 years and also president of Palliative Care Western Australia. For such a man to choose suicide over a natural death speaks volumes about the inability of the current system to adequately deal with suffering. Now, I know Peter in his book has written about the suicide of his friend John Hurst, who seems to have sought help in arranging his death, and I understand his family was unaware of his plans. Now, without commenting specifically, it is increasingly common for people to make these secret arrangements to die, and they do that in order to protect their loved ones from prosecution. If a person has made the decision to die, people may turn to organisations like Exit to give them information about how to die most efficiently, without mess and without implicating others. If nothing else, this is a better option than the nail gun. Would not society be better served by allowing these people to choose a peaceful death at home with their loved ones, maybe the dog, without the collateral damage associated with these lonely and often violent suicides. The next claim is that there will be a dreadful impact on doctors and medical staff. It's claimed that the bond between the doctor and the patient will be destroyed and the duty to do no harm damaged. But if a doctor has the means to relieve a patient's suffering but cannot or will not do so, surely that is doing harm. And in reality, doctors help patients to die all the time. Everyone knows it. This nudge, nudge, wink, wink, assisted dying is unregulated and unreported and sometimes done without the patient's consent. So lucky you if you happen to have a doctor who will ease your path. But what about the possibility of abuse? What are the safeguards? Surely those who oppose VAD laws must be concerned about this awful practice. But strangely, VAD opponents, doctors and MPs are happy to leave this as the status quo. So how is it intellectually or morally supportable to oppose legal assisted dying while at the same time condoning illegal assisted dying? That makes no sense. The position of parts of the healthcare sector have undeniably been influenced by ideology and religion instead of science and evidence. Faith-based groups provide a majority of the private healthcare and palliative care in Australia. They won't provide services inconsistent with their beliefs, and many doctors hold strong ideological and religious views on VAD. And absolutely there should be allowance for conscientious objection in VAD laws. But in what world of medical ethics is it appropriate for a physician's own moral or religious views on death and dying to influence the care they provide to their patients? Now, doctors' groups have traditionally been opposed to VAD, but that is changing quite rapidly, many groups moving from opposition to neutrality. Evidence is clear, the sky hasn't fallen in. The Australian College of GPs actively supported the Victorian law in 2017. Recently, the College of Physicians, and this includes the specialty of palliative care, has revised its position from opposed to critical neutrality. Palliative care are also reviewing their position. Now, the AMA, interesting to note that it represents less than 30% of Australian doctors, they remain opposed, but they do state that it's ultimately a matter for society and government. So what does society and government think about VAD? When 85% of the community supports an issue, governments should be listening. People are concerned about how they die. They're not idiots, and they've seen the end of life, and many are very frightened about it. The demographic bulge of baby boomers have watched their parents die and now face their own deaths. They're focused on quality of life and quality of death. They're active participants in their medical care, so the days of accepting this patronising doctor-knows-best medical care are well and truly over. So polling shows...
You're going to have to finish in about 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay, that's fine. Polling shows support around 85%, and this is majority support across all states, all demographics, all political persuasions, and among Christians. So COTA, Council on the Ageing, peak body for the elderly, they've just surveyed Australians aged over 50. Support for VAD is 84%. Now that represents 7 million voters. Governments should ignore this group at their peril, yet MPs continue to do so, basing opposition on the most spurious of grounds. So just to give you an idea of two of these spurious grounds, I call on issues raised in the parliamentary debates in New South Wales and Victoria. So the first is that assisted dying is state-sanctioned killing. It's a Rubicon that cannot be crossed. In 2017, this was raised by almost all New South Wales MPs who voted no to VAD. Many also mentioned the Nazis. But months earlier, the same MPs happily voted for shoot-to-kill laws. We send soldiers to war knowing that some will die and civilians will be killed. Governments make decisions all the time which affect the lives and deaths of individuals. The second pathetic argument is that it's too hard. It's too hard to safely legislate for assisted dying. Medical protocols deal with complex issues involving life and death all the time. Returning to the analogy of warfare, there are detailed rules governing armed conflict. Rules of engagement even specify when it's lawful to shoot a child soldier. Don't tell me that it is beyond the capacity of our elected representatives to deal with suffering at end of life. Is there something deficient about our MPs that they can't grapple with laws that have been successfully introduced in 7 US states, Canada, Switzerland, the Netherlands, Belgium, and now Victoria? There's ample evidence from these jurisdictions showing these laws are safe and effective, safeguarded from abuse, and importantly, well supported by the community and the healthcare sector. Switzerland. It has been legal to assist a suicide in some circumstances since the 1940s. This is a safe and prosperous country. If VAD laws really posed a grave risk to society, surely the Swiss would have noticed it by now. It's only been 70 years. So putting the culture to death, tearing at the fabric of society, slippery slopes, I just don't think so. The evidence doesn't support it, and there are compelling reasons to believe that VAD laws will actually benefit both individuals and society. Thanks.
Many thanks to Penny. Reverend Peter Curdy, welcome.
Thank you.
So you can go 20 minutes and that's it.
Okay, thank you, Gerald. Thanks very much. And thank you for your welcome back to the Sydney Institute. It's great to be here again, and I'm very pleased to be able to address this and to have been able to talk to Penny about this important issue. And I'd like to thank Penny for the way in which she has presented what is a very complex and an emotionally fraught issue. No one denies that. And I should just say, although I'm billed as an Anglican minister, I've just been introduced as such, the argument I'm making is, in fact, not based on any religion, on my own religious beliefs at all. The old canon that objections to physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia are based solely on religious belief, a canon which I'm afraid Penny repeated tonight, they're unfounded. In fact, there are many Christians, and she has said this, who are in favour of euthanasia, most notably, in fact, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, George Carey. And there are many, many Australian Christians and in senior positions in the churches who are in favour. Moreover, if it were true that the only objection to euthanasia was based on religion, there would indeed be little to warrant imposing that prohibition beyond the communities of faith. I completely agree with Penny on that. My argument, therefore, is grounded on a different set, or grounded in a different set of concerns. The concerns that in making it legal to kill another person, we will tear at the moral and cultural fabric of our society. It's a topic of tremendous importance as people age and medical technology improves and, of course, resources for healthcare come under increasing pressure. So it's a tremendously important question. And it calls into question fundamental beliefs about the nature of human life and well-being. And I do think it challenges some of our key moral principles about the deliberate taking of life, for that is what it is. And yet it does appear to enjoy high levels of support among Australians. Again, Penny is absolutely right. A news poll conducted in August last year, for example, found that 79% of those surveyed favoured amending the law to allow a physician to assist somebody to commit suicide. Only 15% were opposed. But legalising this practice is going to have very significant and serious impacts on individuals and on society, and I believe that we need to proceed with immense caution. It's not enough, I think, Penny, again, I agree with her, that it's not enough for legislators to say it's too difficult. It's not too difficult. It's been done. Victoria has done it in this country. And I'm sure there will be another move made here in New South Wales before long, and there will be a move in Western Australia in the course of this year. So it's not too hard. The question is not can we do it? The question is should we do it? Is this a step that society should make? In many respects, I think the debate is driven by anxiety about human suffering. And I understand that. I do understand that. And for the most part, it does concern those with incurable and terminal illnesses. Although, interestingly enough, in the state of Oregon, where there has been a very well-regimented practice of assisted suicide over many years, there's now a health bill before the legislators there, which will change the meaning of terminal disease. So it's been legal in Oregon since the late 90s, and there's been a series of meticulous reports that substantiate some of the many claims that Penny makes about the practice. But there's a new move to redefine terminal illness as meaning a disease that will, within reasonable medical judgment, produce or substantially contribute to a patient's death. Well, you know, that could be flu, frankly. The anxiety also extends to those for whom age has simply taken its toll and who are increasingly dependent on others. And I call to mind Dr. David Goodall, who flew to Switzerland last year, or the year before, and was assisted to die. People dying a slow, painful death, we are told, are forced to endure such suffering because a cruel law prevents them obtaining the law that they seek. And yet this supposedly cruel law is actually the law that prohibits the deliberate taking of human life. Is that something we want to tamper with? I believe that we tamper with that law at our peril. Vulnerable people can be manipulated by others who may no longer want the burden of caring or who want to enrich themselves. Take depressed Queensland woman Jennifer Morant. Now, she may have suffered from chronic pain and wanted to die, but she was not terminally ill when her husband, who was incidentally the sole beneficiary of her $1.4 million life insurance policy, helped end her life, and the Supreme Court of Queensland convicted him of assisting her suicide. Let's be clear that the debate is not about whether or not we die. Penny made that point very clearly at the beginning. It's about how we die. We are all going to die, but how are we going to die? Proponents argue that since a patient is going to die anyway, the end should be hastened, if desired, in the name of human dignity. But there is a crucial legal and moral difference between allowing death to occur naturally and bringing about death deliberately and intentionally. The ends, that is to say, the relief of suffering, in my view, must never justify the means, killing a person. This does not mean that those opposed to legalizing euthanasia and assisted suicide are in some way, some perverted way, in favor of suffering. No one denies that the medical profession ought to strive for the relief of all suffering. More resources need to be committed to palliative care. And an important point that Penny made is the fact that I think that this debate in some ways is redirecting attention to the provision of palliative care. As society talks more about end-of-life issues, so more attention is paid to palliative care. And it could well be, as Penny said, it could well be that we will see a resurgence of commitment of resources to palliative care. Disagreement, though, coming back to the debate itself, arises over how to bring about the relief for patients. Advocates say that in the name of compassion, people should not be kept alive against their wishes and should be allowed to die when they choose. And of course, there are heartrending stories. We've heard some of them tonight about people who have endured extremely difficult suffering and suffering that's been extremely difficult to relieve. I still say it's hardly justifiable to change the law to permit assisted suicide simply because of hard cases, when doing so may be at the expense of the rights and protections of others. I don't deny for a moment that people endure suffering. Does the law need to change? And if we do change the law, what are the consequences that will flow from that? Those are my concerns. Of course, any person already has the right to refuse treatment. This is an important point. Even if refusal leads to an increased risk of death. And the right to refuse treatment or to request treatment to be withdrawn is very different, though, from asserting the right to die or the right to be killed. Allowing the patient to die at some point is a practical condition of the successful operation of modern medicine. But killing a patient is not. As Margaret Somerville has observed pithily, we must kill the pain and suffering, not the person with the pain and suffering. Proposing one approach to pain relief often gives way to a willingness to compromise on ends and means. For some, the issue is not about pain or dignity or suffering. It's about having the opportunity for assistance in committing suicide once life no longer has meaning. And the Oregon Dying with Dignity data summaries show, in fact, that the vast majority of people who do ingest the medication, and Penn is right, more people receive it than ingest it, but of those who do ingest it, most are concerned about quality of life. It's not about pain or suffering, it's about the quality of life and the sense that they have, the capacity that they feel they have to participate in that life. One critic, in response to an article I wrote, said this: "This is not about a person being killed, which Curti conflates with assisted suicide. It's about whether they should be allowed to have doctors assist them to make the voluntary ending of their lives as humane and compassionate as possible. But if it is about that, I think my critic is wrong. Although committing suicide is no longer illegal in Australia, every death by intentional self-harm, however it's brought about, has a profound impact on others. The state has removed itself from what is fundamentally a moral question by declaring that suicide is not illegal. But the social taboo surrounding suicide remains. It's not that the state controls or retains control of life, but that it has an interest in not acting so as to weaken the taboo surrounding suicide. Suicide is never an entirely private act. It always has an enormous impact on the family, friends, and community of the deceased. When self-destruction, whatever terms in which it's couched, but whenever self-destruction is redefined as medical treatment, I think we lose our ability as a society to make a decision on the rightness or wrongness of the suicide. Whether we think that suicide is moral or immoral, we must not simply go with the cultural flow that would render it a neutral act. In his magisterial and highly readable study on suicide, called On Suicide, by Emil Durkheim, remarked, "When society has lost its moral compass, its own uncertainty inspires in it a kind of indulgence of immoral acts, which is involuntarily expressed whenever they are mentioned, and which makes their immorality less appreciable. Indulgence of what I consider to be the immoral acts, to use Durkheim's term, of euthanasia and assisted suicide, suggests to me that we need to heed Durkheim's warning, issued in those last years of the 19th century. Today, society's loss of a moral bearing has led us to emphasize ends over means. It sanctions the view that it is for the individual alone to decide whether or not life has meaning. And it was my concern about the skewing of that moral compass that prompted me to write this short book. And my thinking about this, as Penny has said, was activated, really kicked into play by the death of John Hirst. And it led me to consider the arguments that are made in favour of legalisation, and to come to the conclusion that the most humane response to human suffering is, in fact, not to make this practice legal. Ideas about dignity, about personal autonomy, and about freedom from interference by the state are all threads woven through the debate. And I'm pro-dignity, I'm pro-personal autonomy, and I'm pro-minimal interference from the state. But we must also attend to the possible impact of legalized physician-assisted suicide on the medical profession. And Penny has said something, made some remarks in great detail about this, and I think she said some very, very important things. I would like to add, however, that once doctors are licensed to kill, there is surely a real danger that a patient's trust in the authenticity of a doctor's professed commitment to her well-being will almost certainly be undermined. Acts of mercy must not be expressed by acts of mercy killing. Damage to the relationship between doctor and patient will also damage the standing of the profession of medicine, and this in turn will inflict damage on the wider society. The impacts on individuals and society will be vast. Many nursing organisations may be in favour, but increasingly doctors' organisations, particularly in the United States, where the practice is lawful, as Penny has said, doctors' associations are starting to have second thoughts about the practice. I do fear that demands for legalization of assisted suicide and euthanasia amount to a one-way ratchet, in effect, asserting the primacy of autonomy. But these demands need to be resisted because of the impact such autonomous choices will have on the wider society. Continued legalization will in Australia will enshrine in law a rejection of the duties that I believe we owe to others. And I say this not as a minister of religion, I say this as a citizen of our society. We do owe duties to one another. And we must bear claims that others make upon us. Legalizing this practice will help to normalize the idea that the lives of some people are not worth living. And this is an important point made by the British peer Baroness Elora Finlay, who is a distinguished professor of palliative medicine. She says this: we should not forget that laws are more than just regulatory instruments. They also send powerful social messages. An assisted dying law sends the subliminal message, however unintended by legislators, that if we are terminally ill, taking our own lives is something we should consider. Changing the social message of the law changes its dynamic. I think that Lady Finlay is correct. By changing the law, we are threatening the social, legal, and cultural norms underlying civil society. And we must also resist arguments made by proponents of the practice that none of these considerations can ever outweigh the supposed primacy of individual choice. Indeed, it's these very considerations, I think, that must override the assertion of individual autonomy. Demands for physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia is growing, demand is growing, and it's becoming more widely available in Europe, especially Belgium and the Netherlands, and an increasing number of states in the United States. Hawaii, I think, was the most recent state to legalize the practice. But the surge in demand has prompted stark warnings from some who were formerly advocates of the practice. The Dutch bioethicist Theodor Burr initially supported the legalization of euthanasia in the Netherlands, but now with the expansion of categories, the expansion of those eligible for the practice, with the slide down the slippery slope that many people deny exists, including Penny, but I'm afraid I think there is a slope and I think it is very slippery. Boer himself is now concerned that the exceptional situations, and that's always what the emphasis is placed upon, exceptional, traumatic, difficult situations, that those situations, says Boer, for which the law was created, have evolved into an acceptance of organized death. A border is being crossed between individual empathy and societal acceptance, he says. A culture of euthanasia undermines our capacity to deal with suffering, and that is very bad for society. This from a former proponent of the practice. Yet just such a culture of euthanasia threatens to take hold in Australia, and indeed already has. The legalization of assisted suicide and euthanasia in Australia will enshrine in law a rejection of the duties that we owe to others and of the claims others have upon us. As such, I think it poses a threat to the cultural, social, and legal norms underlying our civil society. And as such, I believe it must be resisted. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks to Peter Curti, and thanks to Penny Hackett. As I said, we've got copies of Peter's book, Euthanasia Putting the Culture to Death, on sale tonight. And you can order through the Go Gentle website copies of the Damage Done book, with which Penny's Dying with Dignity New South Wales is associated. Now we come to questions and discussion. There are a lot of people here, so you've got to keep your question or your comment brief. And we'll get both our speakers up here. Peter, if you come this side. Penny, you'll have to speak right now. No, Peter, come around this, just here.
Sorry.
Yeah, and Penny, you'll have to speak into the microphone, lest you not be heard. Okay? So, I'm going to start off briefly to both of you, but I want brief responses. I've had a lot of dealings with politicians over a lot of years, and they've been mentioned tonight, but my understanding of the politicians' reaction is that they don't want to be responsible for bringing down legislation which might be used by someone to kill someone else or put pressure on someone else. So it seems to me that the, what politicians are not acting on any great religious, most of them on any great religious feeling, but just a concern because they've met a lot of people over many, many years and they really know how a lot of people think. So a quick response from either or both and then we'll move on.
Do you want to go first?
I'm happy to go first. The issue of people being coerced or persuaded to take voluntary assisted dying, of course there are issues about vulnerable people, but I would suggest that these MPs have not read the legislation. The protections, the eligibility criteria are the protections and eligibility criteria are absolutely clear. So, for example, the risk of elder abuse. Now, that is a real problem in our society, and it's definitely happening. If anyone really wanted to get rid of an elderly relative, going through a process that involves two doctors, written, verbal consent, waiting period, would seem to me to be more likely to expose elder abuse than to facilitate it. And similarly, with people who are disabled or mental illness, disability and mental illness of themselves do not qualify you for assisted dying. You may have a disability and a terminal illness, in which case, why should you be prevented from taking advantage of these laws?
Peter? Well, in many respects, I agree with Penny. I think the reason that the law, that the politicians are hesitant to act is because it is an enormous subject, and I think there are our politicians do have a sense of the moral consequences of legislating. It's one of the reasons why I think it's taking a long time. I mean, Australia is quite a long way behind other countries, other Western countries in this respect. And I think that is a measure of the difficulty and of the care that the politicians are taking. So I see not so much as a refusal, although it could well be that people have not read the legislation. I think that's unlikely, though. I think people have read, politicians do read legislation very carefully.
Sorry.
You don't think so?
No.
Okay, all right. Well, okay.
Well, having worked with them, I think they do, actually.
Okay. Well, let's leave politicians aside. I think it's a measure of the difficulty, whether or not they read it. I think the fact that they are politicians should be in touch and with community sentiment and will want to proceed carefully and cautiously, I would think. But my sense is that it's coming in Australia. I mean, we've had it in Victoria. I think it'll come in Western Australia. And I think it'll come in New South Wales. And I think, I mean, I could be wrong about that, but my sense is that we're moving in that direction. And that's a measure of the extent to which I think politicians are willing to respond to community concerns.
There's a question here. Just be brief.
No, I have a question for Reverend Curdy. The Netherlands has had a lot of experience, certainly in recent years, with physician-assisted suicide. And you mentioned a Dutch philosopher or a Dutch expert who had changed his views. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more of what is the evidence that he used to change his views. Was it just a feeling, or was there some hard evidence that would actually help to inform the debate here and in other places?
Thank you, David. That's a good question. I think he's a bioethicist, and I think he was concerned by the change in practice that he's witnessed around him in the Netherlands. And it's certainly the case that it's in Belgium and the Netherlands that we have seen reported cases of involuntary euthanasia of minors, people who are severely disabled. No, that's been documented.
No, please, look.
No.
Sorry. But at the Sydney Institute, we don't have interruptions. Sorry. People can ask a question and get an answer. So behave like everyone else does. Can you continue?
Yes, I will continue. But these are documented cases. Now, I think it's a big question because practice is in the... there are questions about the way in which the practice has been monitored in Belgium and the Netherlands. I think there is a lot of concern in those countries about category expansion and about the creeping practice and a growing acceptance. I'd like to just go back across the Atlantic from there to Oregon, where in fact the practices have been very meticulously recorded in the Dying with Dignity Act reports, the data summaries. And there, research has shown that in fact there's little apparent evidence of abuse or misuse of the system there. So it makes me wonder, without having done a detailed analysis of the data from the Netherlands and Belgium, it makes you wonder there how significantly practiced there differs from that in Oregon. And in a few weeks' time, actually, a few days' time, we'll have the 2018 data summary from Oregon released, which will show, I expect, again, that more people receive the medication than ingest it, that more people, that there is a steady increase, but not a spike or a surge, and that the categories are not expanding. I think Netherlands and Belgium cause me concern.
You want to make a comment on that, Penny?
Just that these reported cases, they're constantly referred to, and there's really only about 8 situations that the opponents keep bringing back and back and back and back. Now, does anyone really think that the community in the Netherlands or Belgium would sit by and let this continue if they were killing disabled children? It's just not credible. A lot of the report, these things which are reported, in some instances what they're doing is going outside the parameters of the assisted dying scheme, and they're looking at situations that arise all over the world in medical treatment. So the issue of allowing a child to die who has no prospect of life, that's got nothing to do with voluntary assisted dying. That's standard medical practice all over the world. Similarly, with withdrawal of treatment and people who are assisted to die, this is my nudge-nudge, wink-wink euthanasia, that is not part of a voluntary assisted dying scheme. We know it happens all the time. A number of those deaths are reported within some of the Netherlands and Belgium data.
Just
really briefly, to Shania, it was the 6th of March last year, a story in the Washington Post that talked about that. Now, it's sometimes since I've read that story, and it could be that the reporter was completely misguided and making it up, but there is some record, and this reporter has found some evidence to prompt him to write the story, and there's enough credence for his editors to run it. The 6th of August, 2018, the Washington Post article by Charles Lane.
Jeremy Sammet from the Centre for Independent Studies. I've got a question to Penny.
Penny, just come up
the
here.
The changing attitudes of the medical profession, doctors and nurses. much of modern medicine has become incredibly clinical in the sense of being very neat and clean. The exception is patients who are old and sick and dying. They're also very resource-intensive patients. Doctors, also, at least in the public system, work in a resource-constrained environment. I was wondering if that might give you pause for thought about what might be the underlying reasons driving changes of attitude amongst the medical profession.
No, I don't think that has anything to do with it, but there is a real fundamental shift in attitude in the medical profession. So they're now realising that just because they can keep someone alive for a very long period doesn't mean that they should. So there's great work being done by particularly people like Professor Kent Hillman dealing with identifying frailty and treating that as if it were a terminal disease, if you like, because the indications of medical frailty are a fairly good predictor of how much longer a person has to live. So issues of medical resourcing, some of these intensive care specialists are saying, well, we have all of these old people who are suffering from terrible illnesses. They're brought in from nursing homes, they're resuscitated, they have things attached to them, they have tubes stuck down their throats, and they probably are going to die quite soon afterwards, and a lot of them don't really want to live. So there's a whole issue of effectively patient-centred care, rights to refuse treatment, advanced care directives, all of those things. It's personal choice. If you want to live, then you may want heroic efforts to keep you alive, and the doctors will respect that. If you don't, and you don't want to be resuscitated, stomach tube fed, that sort of thing, then you don't have to undertake that. It's all about discussion and also the medical profession respecting people's wishes. I don't think at all this is led by the doctors. They're quite happy to just do what they've been doing, curing things, making exciting medical discoveries, but they are starting to realise that they need to rethink death and dying and give people a better experience. Surprisingly to me, I always thought doctors were very experienced dealing with people at the end of their lives, but they appear to be very reluctant to talk about it. So instead of telling someone that they're dying, they will often offer another treatment. It may be futile, it may actually be damaging to the patient to have that treatment, but rather than sort of have an honest conversation and say, I don't know that this treatment is going to work for you, perhaps you should consider stopping treatment and going to palliative care. I would have thought that was doctor's bread and butter, but they say themselves that they're uncomfortable about those discussions, and that needs to change.
There's a question for you.
Just a very general question. Do either of you have any idea how many people have taken up the option of voluntary assisted dying since the legislation was passed in Victoria?
It hasn't started yet.
It's in July.
Late June. But interestingly, in Oregon, so 20 years last year, only about 1,900 people have actually received the prescription, and only about 1,200 or 1,300 have taken it. And that's in 20 years. So as a proportion of deaths in Oregon, it's sitting pretty consistently at 0.45%.
Peter, have you got any steps on that?
No, Penny's right. The numbers are low in Oregon, and I think it's also borne out by the fact that the conditions, the terms and conditions of eligibility are quite strict there. You've got to be resident in Oregon for 12 months at least. As in Victoria, you can't just move to Victoria and get the stuff. So I think that the fact that it's not easy for people outside Oregon to avail themselves. You have to be an Oregonian, you have to have lived there, you have to be a member of that state. Means that the pool, and it's not a terribly popular state, means that the pool of people is quite small, but it's interesting that the numbers have not grown. I think that's right.
Yes, I'd just like to say I'm actually an intensive care nurse for more than 40 years, and I've worked both in Australia, England, the Netherlands, and the United States. And I'd like to say I very much agree with what Penny's got to say, that there's a lot of end-of-life medication given, and it's always been given for the last 40-plus years to patients that are really at the end of their life. It's nod, nod, wink, wink, say no more. And even though people have the right to life, I truly believe people have the right to death. And a lot of people don't know, and their families don't know, when to stop. And looking back on what was done to their mothers, their fathers, their husbands, people often say, I wish I'd stopped sooner. And my advice to everybody here is to write an advance directive and say exactly what you want done and exactly what you do not want done. Because to see one dying and drowning is absolutely horrendous. And I'd ask both of you, do you agree with that or do you not agree with that?
100%.
I agree in part. I want to say, first of all, I have enormous respect for your experience, and you have seen things that I have not seen. I do have an advanced care directive. I do not want to be resuscitated. I mean, it states a number of other things as well. So I think it is very important to be clear about what kind of what I don't want in terms of intervention. But I still think we are taking a significant moral step when we go from there, the withholding of treatment or the withdrawing of treatment, to the introduction of an agent that will deliberately end the life of a person. And that's the step that I have difficulty with. But I have great respect for your experience, and I think I do agree with you. I think that, and I've seen this from my own professional experience, that it can be very difficult for family to know when is enough, and how long is too long. They are difficult questions, and I don't think there are any formulaic responses.
It's going to be brief. We're running up to time.
Peter, I'd just like to point out to everyone that's here that the laws in Victoria and the laws proposed in Western Australia, New South Wales, Tasmania, etc., are based on the American model. So can you... Yes, it's true that there are a few cases, and it's very few in Europe, but the law is different in Europe. We're talking about terminal illness. So are you aware of a single case in the 21 years where assisted dying has been legal in America, where there has been a case of some sort of abuse?
Thanks, Shane. I can't give you a state-by-state answer, but in Oregon, I don't think there is any evidence at the moment. There's no evidence yet. And I am aware that the law is based on that. I don't think, though, whilst it may, in a sense, one could say, well, you know, it's working, therefore it's not a problem. It seems to be okay, therefore let's enact it. I still think it's not appropriate to enact this sort of legislation. I don't have a prescription for how we address the questions that Sandra has addressed. I do not think that this legislation is the way to do it. But I accept that there are places where it does appear to be working, and Hawaii is the state most recently to have legislated. But increasingly, one reads reports from doctors' organisations and conferences where reservations are coming to be expressed.
Yes, except that more medical associations in the United States are actually moving to the neutral position.
Okay, we can't hear. Yeah. Okay, the suggestion is more American associations are moving towards that position. That was the
neutrality. Neutrality.
Okay. So we're pretty well at the end. Final question.
It's not really a question, it's
a comment.
A friend of ours has for the last year and a bit been very, very ill with cancer. We didn't think she'd be alive now. She's been very strongly in favour of euthanasia, has supported it politically and all sorts of things, as is her husband. And yet, the more she suffers, the more she wants to live. So what I'm just interested to know, is there a desire for something that when we actually face it, we can't really do it? And this is one of the reasons why the politicians are pulling back. It just seems to me that when you talk about the people who take the medicine, whatever the medicine's supposed to be, and then don't use it. And another friend of mine who's a writer, wrote a book about her mother's suicide and got very involved in the euthanasia, pro-euthanasia business. When I asked her, would she come along and join us tonight? She said, I've had enough of it, I'm giving it away. So what is it in this issue with 70% of people say, or 80% saying they're agreeing, but then when these various places where it's been used, it's not used all that much. So what is it about?
No, this is the occasion for final comment, but in the reverse order. So we'll start with Penny, finish with Peter. Yep.
The fundamental thing, like I said, it's not about the dying. The palliative effect of knowing that you have control is relieving of suffering of itself. So it's great that people don't want to die. If people want to live. They fight as hard as they possibly can. And a lot of people's fear about death is because they don't know what it's going to be like, and they think that they can't possibly bear something. They couldn't possibly bear having someone wipe their backside every day. But when they get to that situation, many of them find that it's not that bad after all. But it's the fear that drives people to take their lives. If they did know, if they had the control, if there was a better understanding in the whole community about death and dying so people weren't so fearful of it, that would make a big difference as well. But the fact that not many people take it, I think that's a good thing.
Yes, thanks, Joe. Just to add to that, Anne, I think Penny's right. I think fear and anxiety about end of life drives a lot of this. That, as you said, you know, baby boomers are seeing parents die. My own parents died over a decade ago, and we increasingly we see this. We think, well, I don't want that. My mother had a good death. My father was a slightly protracted death. But we think, well, I don't want to go like that. I don't want that to be in that situation. I don't want that for myself. And I think we do get anxious about that. I'm concerned that by legislating for these sorts of practices, though, we are starting to normalise the therapeutic, as it were, the therapeutic administration of death, when there are other and better ways. And in my view, it's a non-Christian view. My secular view is that there are more moral ways of doing that. Could I just add a coda to that and say that I really appreciate the conversations that I've had with Penny and previously with Shane about this. I think it is a vexed and in many ways a harrowing conversation. But I think it's extremely important that we talk to one another and listen to one another. And I'm grateful for the civility with which we've been able to do that. And I should add that the book is dedicated to a very dear friend, Rivka Hartman, who I've known for many years. We are very close. She is passionately opposed to my position, diametrically opposed. But we are able to enjoy friendship and conversation and discussion, and I think it is extremely important that we do have these sorts of conversations, and that they are always civil and they don't descend into the hurling of brickbats, which in my view achieves very little.
Thanks, Peter. Yeah. So many thanks to Penny Hackett and Peter Curti. Look, this is can be a highly emotive issue, and I think at the Sydney Institute we always have rational, considered debate, and that's what we've had tonight. We've heard two articulate views, broadly opposed, not totally opposed, and we've had a good exchange with everyone who's here tonight, and we're now finishing right on time, and in view of the contentions involved, I'm not going to say anything more than just to remind you about the books and to say to both our speakers, well done and thank you. Penny?
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.